Okay, good morning. We appreciate you staying about for the last panel of this year's SEALS Conference. This panel is on the individual healthcare mandate and enumerated powers, sponsored by the Federal Society for Law and Public Policy. I'm Brad Smith. I'll be your generally very quiet moderator this morning. We are making a podcast of this, and the hotel doesn't have very good equipment for doing that. So I've asked the speakers to pass the mic back and forth so it comes up, and when you ask questions, when we get to that, I'll ask you to speak loudly if you can. I'd asked each of the participants to give me little biographies, but then I realized that I didn't want to spend a lot of time introducing them. Most of them are probably well known to you. Suffice to say that our four panelists have published over 30 books and over 200 articles and reviews. And it's a good time to have this panel because just this week, as you probably saw, unless you've been too involved in the sun of Palm Beach, the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Virginia issued a ruling denying the government's 12B6 motion to dismiss the case in Virginia versus Sebelius. So our panelists today to discuss this case and the principles involved are, to my immediate right, Professor Randy Barnett, who's the Carmack Waterhouse Professor of Law at Georgetown University Law Center. Professor Barnett was also counsel in Gonzales v. Raich a few years ago, which I mention only because I noticed in the opinion that was issued on Tuesday, I guess, it was that case was discussed at some length. Next to him, going second, will be Jack Balkin, again known to many of you. He's the Knight Professor of Constitutional Law at Yale Law School, and of course, well known popularly for his Balkanization blog. And then over to my left, going third, I guess on my far left, will be David Coppell. He's the research director at the Independence Institute in Colorado and an adjunct professor of advanced constitutional law at Denver University's Sturm School of Law, or Sturm College of Law. And then going last to my immediate left here is Gilliam Metzger, professor of law at Columbia University, former clerk to Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and the author of an amicus brief defending the statute filed on behalf of constitutional law professors. Each person is going to speak for about 10 minutes. I'll allow them to do a little bit of rebuttal and crossfire, and then we'll have some time to open it up for questions from the floor. So, Professor Barnett.
Thank you, Brad, and great pleasure to be here. I thought for my talk that I would approach this as a briefing on the theory that many of you will be teaching constitutional law this year. It's probably why you might have stuck around for this panel. This issue is obviously going to be on the forefront of your students' minds, unless you are heavily involved in the litigation, and if you were, I'd probably know it. You probably haven't been keeping up with all the arguments in the case, and most law professors, until maybe this week, have dismissed constitutional challenges to the individual mandate in particular, as well as to the Medicaid provisions as, shall we say, frivolous up until now. And so you probably haven't paid close attention to what's going on. And so what I would like to do is to sort of brief you on the basic outlines or the basic structure of the arguments as they have progressed since about last December, so that you could be in a position to teach the material if you want to or know exactly whether you want to decide whether you want to teach it. One of the things that makes this a very interesting topic to teach is that it really cuts across Commerce Clause, Necessary and Proper Clause, and if you listen to Jack, it also cuts across the tax power. So what I'll do is I'll talk about the Commerce Clause, I'll say a little bit about the tax power, I'll let, I assume Jack will say much more about that, I'm really not sure, but just based on our prior exchanges, I think he will, and then I'll say something about the Necessary and Proper Clause. So let me just talk about the Commerce Clause first. When the Senate bill, and for those of you who haven't followed this that closely, the bill that we're talking about that was enacted was the Senate bill. The way this went down was the Senate passed this bill, the House passed this bill. Then it would normally have gone into reconciliation, but after Scott Brown was elected in Massachusetts and denying the Democrats a filibuster-proof 60 votes, the choice they really had was to enact the Senate bill word for word with some modifications to be made in reconciliation process. And so they basically went with the Senate bill. So that's why we start talking about this with the Senate bill that gets passed in December. And at that time, the Republicans in Senate made a constitutional objection, which is their right to do, and then there was a debate on the floor of Congress about the constitutionality of the bill, and in particular on the constitutionality of the individual mandate. So far to date, publicly, most of the discussion, and what I'm going to focus on, is the constitutionality of the, what the bill refers to as the requirement that all Americans obtain insurance from a private insurance company, subject to what the bill refers to as a penalty, be a financial penalty, and that penalty would be collected by the IRS. And that's what's mostly been discussed. There's another aspect that I'm not going to talk about, which is equally interesting, and that is the challenge to the various provisions that are being imposed on states upon pain of losing their Medicaid funding. So the issue there under South Dakota, I'll just say this, the issue there under South Dakota versus Dole is whether the threat of cutting off 100% of all Medicaid funds is coercive in the words of South Dakota versus Dole, whereas you'll remember in South Dakota versus Dole, what was at issue there was 5% of highway construction funds, which the court said was not coercive. So I think that's what the argument is hinged on. If it is coercive, then it might actually amount to commandeering of the states, but I'm not going to say any more about that. Here, it's not something that I've really focused on that much in my own writings on the subject. I'm really talking about the Commerce Clause, the individual mandate, which in the original Senate bill, and which is the enacted bill, justified in the findings in that bill solely on the grounds as a regulation of commerce. There are 8 findings in the bill, in the actual statute, and all of the findings concern the effect of all of the health insurance business on interstate commerce and the fact that the individual mandate is necessary in order to effectuate other provisions of the bill, which are themselves justified as regulations on the insurance business under the Commerce Clause. So the 8 findings of the bill are all Commerce Clause in nature, and it's unsurprising then that the Republicans made a constitutional objection that this was beyond the powers of Congress under the Commerce Clause. And the most easy to explain reason why that would be true is the argument that never before in American history has the Commerce Clause power been used to impose a mandate on all Americans to enter into a commercial relationship with a private company. Or another way of putting it, never before has there been a mandate imposed on the American people to engage in economic activity. Up till today, all previous exercises of the Commerce Clause have involved either regulating people who have chosen to engage in economic activity, which are most of the cases that you're familiar with, or in the case, for example, of the race case, which I litigated to the Supreme Court, a prohibition on engaging in economic activity. So up till now, the Commerce Clause power has been used to regulate economic activity or prohibit economic activity, but it's never been used until this date to mandate economic activity. And I can prove to you that this is true. Obviously, everybody makes claims about what's in the history, and you all are properly skeptical to say, well, if I really knew the cases, I would know X was true. But I can prove this is true in 2 ways. One is because if there ever had been a mandate on the American people that they must engage in commercial activity upon paying a penalty owed to the IRS, you all would know about it because you would all have to have complied with that mandate at some point in your lives. Or maybe in history it had happened, but at least in your lives it's never happened. And the other way I can prove to you it's never happened is that since this argument has been made that this mandate is unprecedented, the people who support the bill have been unable to come forward with any example of where it's been done before. So one would think that they would have by now, and they haven't. So I think on both those scores, you can accept the claim that this has never been done before. On the other hand, the fact that it's never been done before doesn't necessarily mean it can't be done now. The court is perfectly capable of extending the powers of Congress to something that's never been done before. It's done it before. That it's done before. And so the fact that it's unprecedented doesn't dictate the outcome of the lawsuit. It doesn't dictate the outcome of the challenge. But it does affect, in some sense, the plausibility of the challenge. It does suggest that we're talking about breaking new ground, and will there be, you know, is there a justification in law for an extension of Congress's power to this point, or are there some problems with it? And also, are there 5 votes on the Supreme Court to extend Congress's power where it has never been gone before? So that's the first part of what I'll say. There was a discussion of, and I'm not sure if I really want to have time to talk about the tax power at all, but upon this argument being publicly made, beginning in December of last year, there then came to be a public defense of the bill that it was in fact an appropriate exercise of the tax power rather than an exercise of Commerce Clause power. And that culminated on the day of passage of the bill, the Joint Committee on Taxation issued a report, a staff report, saying, characterizing the mandate as an excise tax. Now, it's not, there's no such language in the bill itself, but there was a report that was issued either the day the bill was enacted or the day after the bill was enacted. So it gives you an idea that by the time the bill was enacted, the Senate bill was enacted, at least people in the House were concerned enough about this to try to come up with an ancillary theory to justify the constitutionality of this. And I don't want to say a lot about this. Maybe I'll have a chance to say about it more later. I will only say this about the tax power. If this doesn't change the unprecedented nature of this situation. Even if it is an exercise of the tax power has never been used before to mandate all Americans engage in an economic activity. And so that itself doesn't change the very unprecedented nature of this. And the other thing I would say about the tax power that I think will not be as true about the Commerce Clause, and that is if this power, two things I'll say about the tax power. One is that the court has defined an exercise of a tax power or a tax as a measure that has a revenue-raising purpose. And I will just say this about the revenue-raising purpose of this Act. First of all, none of the findings suggest a revenue-raising purpose. And secondly, in another provision of the bill, they identify all the revenue provisions of the Act for purposes of scoring its cost, which is, you know, a very big deal to figure out how much it costs, and the penalty, which is being imposed for failure to comply with the requirement, is not listed among the revenue-raising provisions of the Act, which suggests that at least in the Act itself, there's a good reason to question whether it has a revenue-raising purpose and doesn't fit the definition of the tax. And the final thing I'll say about the tax argument is that if this is a power that Congress does have, it really is a limitless power. It really does mean that anything that Congress wants to make you do or stop you from doing, they simply may do by calling this a tax and having the IRS enforce it, which I think is really a fine, by creating a fine and having the IRS enforce the fine, they can do whatever they want. That is a power that is previously undiscovered in the Constitution. And I think it won't be discovered this time. I don't think that's the way the case will come out. If the mandate is upheld, and the odds are always that it will be, it won't be upheld on this ground. The last thing I'll talk about is the Necessary and Proper Clause, which is where I think the action is actually going to shift. And the argument has already shifted there. The government has already made the argument. In fact, it's in the findings themselves that the mandate is essential to the regulation of the insurance business, and if you grant that Congress does have the power to regulate the insurance business, which since 1944 the Supreme Court has said Congress does have that power, and then if you grant the further premise that the various regulations imposed on the insurance business are constitutional, such as the no pre-existing conditions and the must issue and the no lifetime cap and all the various other provisions that are imposed on insurance companies, if you grant that those are constitutional, and by the way, those are also not being challenged, then the mandate is essential to the efficacious operation of those provisions and therefore can come in under the Lopez language that says that a law is constitutional if it's essential to a broader regulatory scheme. That would be undercut unless it's operational, and also it would fit within Justice Scalia's concurring opinion in Raich, which makes the same Necessary and Proper Clause argument. So what is the response to that? I'll try to do this in like 1 minute. And the response to that is that I think, by the way, there are some arguments against the necessary side. I'll just tell you that, but I won't go into those now because I don't think they would ultimately prevail. But I think the argument to that is that just because it's necessary does not make it proper. In fact, if you remember in Princeton, New York, those are examples of the commandeering of state legislatures, or in New York, and in Prince, it's the commandeering of state executive branch officials, and in Prince itself, the Necessary and Proper Clause was asserted, and Justice Scalia turned away that challenge on the grounds that just because an act is necessary does not make it proper. This is improper because it violates state sovereignty. It violates the principle of state sovereignty that underlies various provisions of the Constitution, including the Tenth Amendment that says the power is not delegated by this Constitution nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. And that's what I think is really going on with the mandate. This isn't just an argument for litigation. I think this is what's really bothering people about the mandate. It is, I think, a commandeering of the people. It is mandating that the people do things. We do commandeer the people to do some things. We commandeer the people to register for the draft, serve if called, serve on a jury duty, file your tax return, pay your taxes, and I guess also respond to the census taker. There are mandates that we do impose on the people, but we do so, first of all, under other powers. And we do so, I think, because those duties that people, we believe that those are duties that people owe to the government as citizens in return for the protection the government offers in return. And then the issue is this commandeering, is this mandate like that? Is a mandate that is justified solely because it is convenient to the regulation of interstate commerce, is that justified as that kind of duty, or is that a step too far with respect to the duties that we owe as citizens? I think the people that like the mandate are perfectly comfortable with saying you have a duty to do whatever Congress says is in the public interest, and the people who oppose the mandate think that that's not a duty of citizenship in and of itself, and it's also a limitless duty if it were to be recognized. And that's where I think the issue will ultimately be joined, in the lower courts possibly, but certainly in the Supreme Court.
Thank you, Randy. Why don't you just pass that down?
Good morning, everyone. I thought I would just keep going with the direction we're trying to head. Is if you're preparing these materials for your class, how would you explain what the key arguments are? So I'll give you the arguments on the other side, and I think I'll just follow Randy's outline, which seems to me to be very good. So the basic idea is that if the government passes a law, and the law otherwise doesn't violate a fundamental right, then if it's within any of Congress's powers, then the law is constitutional. So in order to strike down the individual mandate, it's not being challenged as violating an individual liberty. So then the question is, what are the possible theories under Article 1, Section 8 or elsewhere? It could either be a regulation of commerce. It could be necessary and proper to make a regulation of commerce work, or it could be within the general powers under the General Welfare Clause to tax and provide for the general welfare. So there are three possible theories. If the government wins on any of those three, then the mandate is constitutional. Put another way, if you wish to strike down the individual mandate, you have to win on all three. So let me begin then with the commerce issues and then move to the tax issue. The argument for the commerce power would be something like this, that we know under Lopez, Morrison, and Raich that where individuals engage in economic activity, even if the economic activity doesn't cross state lines, if the cumulative effect of the economic activity has substantial effects on interstate commerce, then it's within the commerce power. So the question is, where's the activity? And that's the challenge, is that there's no activity here. The answer to that question requires a little detour into understanding the economics of insurance markets. As you know, in insurance, essentially you work off of the risk pool. The larger the risk pool, the more you can take the shock of an individual claimant who has a very large amount to claim. So, in other words, and health insurance has this characteristic. The problem in an insurance market like this is that if you're very young and you're very healthy, you will probably avoid paying insurance until absolutely necessary, because basically you figure you're not going to get sick. Part of the deal in the healthcare reform was that the insurance companies consented to being regulated in new ways I'll get to in a second, if the government would assure that they would bring in a very large number of new people into the risk pool so that they could, in fact, take on the costs of the new regulation. What were the new regulations? They were that you couldn't be denied health care for having a pre-existing condition, that you couldn't have lifetime caps on insurance, and that there were certain other regulations on how insurance companies did business so that they wouldn't, if I may use the vernacular, screw their customers. And the insurance company said, look, all of these extra regulations are going to cost us money, and lots of people are going to come in claiming all sorts of illnesses. We're going to have to pay for them, and this is going to eat into our profit margins. We're going to oppose this health care bill unless you guarantee us bringing in a lot more people. At one point, the administration said, well, how about this? We'll have a bunch of exchanges, and we'll have a public option where customers could buy government-sponsored insurance. And the insurance sales said, no, no, we don't want that. Because if people go to the government-sponsored insurance program, the public option, they won't buy from us. We insist, as part of the deal, that the young and healthy people you bring in don't get to buy government-sponsored insurance. We insist that they buy from us. That is to say, the people who were behind the individual mandate were the insurance companies. They wanted lots of new customers. And so the compromise that was hammered out, that was necessary to get the extra votes in Congress, Lieberman's vote, for example, and Nelson's vote, you remember all this discussion, these people insisted on the fact that there be no public option and that you buy your insurance not from a government-sponsored plan, but from private enterprise. It was thought to be more supportive of private enterprise in the United States. Anyway, that's the deal that was struck. So the argument then goes like this. Do the people who don't buy insurance, do they engage in any economic activity? Another way of asking the question would be, do they engage in any economic decision-making? And the answer is, yes, they do. They make an economic decision about whether or not they want to buy the insurance now or wait till they get sick and buy it later. And creating a rule that says you can't be denied coverage, what's called a shall issue rule, if you have a pre-existing condition, just exacerbates this problem of adverse selection. The only people who will buy insurance are those who are sick or know they're about to be sick, and people who are young and healthy will stay out because they know they can get insurance as soon as they show up in front of an insurance company and say, give me insurance. So therefore, the argument goes, the people who are staying out of the risk pool now are engaged in an economic decision. It's an economic decision that has significant economic consequences. People who currently get sick and don't have insurance do one of three things. They either borrow from their families, a very classic form of insurance, or they purchase over-the-counter medicines in an attempt to try to cure themselves. And the third thing they do is, what they do is they go to emergency rooms and they basically get cured on the government's dimes or the dimes of a private hospital. It's estimated that the cost of this uncompensated care, as it's called, is about $43 billion a year. Cumulatively, that is a substantial effect on interstate commerce. The second possible theory would be a theory that it's necessary and proper, even if you don't regard this as economic activity, regulating it is necessary and proper to make the general regulation of insurance work for the reasons I just offered. You can obviously see that there's a very strong and powerful economic argument why you have to bring people into the risk pool to make it work. Obviously, if you just wanted to have a government-sponsored insurance program, which I would favor, a single-payer program, which I would favor, or a public option, which I would favor, then in fact you could do it differently, but this is the compromise that was hammered out between the insurance companies and the administration, in the name of private enterprise, I should say. The next argument would be, and which is the argument, by the way, which I have been arguing for not since December, but since, I guess, July of 2008. The argument, I was first alerted to this whole debate, this is how I got into it, by two very nice lawyers, Rivkin and Casey, who wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal saying that they couldn't understand how the individual mandate could be constitutional. And I wrote to my blog and I said, well, this is an easy one. This is a tax. It's like taxing pollution or taxing any other activity which causes externalities on the general public. You impose a tax. This is what we learned in Economics 101. It's under the taxing power. It's fine. Anyway, the debate went on, and we had a very interesting debate in University of Pennsylvania Online Law Review, which you can look up, between the three of us. And we basically vetted most of the arguments that are now being vetted. The House bill, in fact, understood it as a tax on income, 2.5% of adjusted gross income. The Senate, for political reasons, did not want to call it a tax, nor did the President. And so they came up with a different linguistic formula, called it a penalty. But basically, the compromise bill that came out and fixed by reconciliation is a kind of penalty that's collected by the IRS, which is an amendment to the Internal Revenue Code, Section 1501, which is part of the Internal Revenue Code. And it says that for every month that you don't purchase insurance after 2014, you will be assessed a penalty according to a complicated formula, a flat rate, or a percentage of adjusted gross income, whichever is greater, capped at the national average premium. So it's a very complicated formula, but income is part of the formula. So the argument would be, is that this looks like a tax. It's in the Internal Revenue Code. It's collected as a tax. The IRS collects it. They can't bring criminal proceedings. They can't bring a tax lien, but they simply deduct it from your refund. That's how it's enforced. Is it within the taxing power? The answer is, the test from Helbrand versus Davis, Social Security tax, is, first of all, does it raise revenue? It is estimated it will raise $4 billion a year. That's a lot of revenue. The second question is, could Congress reasonably have concluded that it promotes the general welfare? And the answer is yes, Congress could have reasonably concluded so for the reasons I just gave. If you think, in fact, requiring regulation of insurance companies so they can't deny people benefits for insurance for pre-existing conditions is within the general welfare? Yes, it is. There are further arguments about direct tax, which I don't have time to get into, but I'd be loved to talk to you about them, but it's not a direct tax. But I really want to end by going to the point that Randy made, which I think is central to understand this. Randy pointed out that what is interesting about this bill, he says unique, I wouldn't say unique, is the idea that it requires people to engage in a form of public insurance. That is, you pay in, and by paying in, you lower insurance rates for everybody else because you join the risk pool. And so the objection is the objection to people participating in a public program which provides a public good that benefits the larger community. That's the objection. And Randy says that's unprecedented in American history. I don't think it is unprecedented in American history. Social Security, as it's currently organized, is in fact a donation of money into the Social Security Fund, which you're paying for yourself, but you're also basically cross-subsidizing another generation. In essence, really what the health insurance bill is about, and which I think President Obama did not make sufficiently clear till the day he signed the bill, was that this is a form of social insurance. It's a social insurance program. It's designed to make sure that no American goes without health insurance. And the way in which you do it is everybody in the country, unless there are exceptions, you're exempted if you have religious objections, for example, everybody in the country pays in, buys insurance, and the result of that cross-subsidization is to make sure that insurance is affordable to everyone. Hence the Affordable Care Act, that's what it's called. It would have been, I would have favored, just simply saying, you get a voucher for health insurance you can buy yourself. The government will give you a voucher. I would prefer a public option. I would prefer a single payer. But that's not what was possible in the world of politics. The very same people who were fighting against the health care bill in the first place also were the people insisting that the money go to private enterprise and not for a new government program. And so after the bill was passed, the same people turned around again and argued that what they demanded was unconstitutional. It seems to me this is the wrong way to think about the bill. The right way to think about the bill is in the tradition of Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Thanks.
We are at a constitutional moment in our nation, and this debate that's going on in public and in the courts will affect what kind of constitution we live in, whether we continue to live in the republic of enumerated powers, limited powers granted to the federal government, or we end up with the opposite of what Madison and Hamilton told us we were getting and what the American people voted for when they created the Constitution and what they have supported ever since, which is a federal government of finite, limited powers. Not one that, like, say, the government of France or the government of the United Kingdom presumptively starts with the ability to do anything it wants, subject to some exceptions on enumerated individual rights. We know where the American people stand on this. They voted, for example, in Missouri this week, 71% against the individual mandate, instructing their legislature to create constitutional protection in the Missouri statutes against this mandate. You can throw out all the policy arguments you want, like Jack does, and complain about the hypocritical Republicans, and that's fine, but the fact is the Constitution is not so infinitely elastic, at least as it's existed so far, that just because you make a good policy argument for something, that it automatically means that Congress has the power to do it. If you were in a state legislature like Massachusetts, you'd have much stronger arguments on this. I mean, this is in some respects copies Romney Care, and there's not a constitutional issue on that because the Massachusetts legislature, unlike Congress, is not one of limited enumerated powers. Wickard versus Filburn, the high mark of Commerce Clause, Interstate Commerce Clause power, even then, nobody claimed that that meant that Congress could order people to buy wheat from government-approved cartel of wheat producers. And whatever policy arguments you could have made, and by the way, which would have been could have been persuasive, because many economists, at least, thought that the problem with the one of the things that was causing the depression was underconsumption. People weren't buying enough, and you could rationally, Congress could certainly rationally have come up with some kind of Keynesian argument that the solution to underconsumption is forced consumption. But whether or not that would have been a good policy argument, and whether or not you could have called the Republicans hypocrites for opposing it, doesn't mean that it was ever, or is now, within the power of Congress to mandate on individuals. As for the tax argument, it gets into some very complex things about direct taxes, indirect taxes, excise taxes, and so on. But we know the constitutional principle, which is Jack and Gillian's brief, said, well, that doesn't count anymore. That's courts don't pay attention to it. But the fact is there are Supreme Court cases which say you can certainly tax something you couldn't regulate, but you cannot use taxation to regulate something which you couldn't regulate under an enumerated power. You can't just throw a tax on something and thereby attach an entire massive regulatory scheme to that. Social Security, of course, is entirely different. You pay the money to the federal government, and then the federal government gives money to various people, the way all taxes work. That's not the forced purchase of a product from a private company that people do not want to purchase. As Randy said, South Dakota versus Dole does say that federal spending cutoffs to the states can sometimes be so coercive as to be unconstitutional violations of state sovereignty. We also know from a string of 11th Amendment and cases in the last 20 years, as well as cases interpreting Section 5 of the 14th Amendment, that the Supreme Court majority does take state sovereignty seriously and is willing to find laws unconstitutional, including if you say you can, for example, allowing the state of Florida to be sued for alleged patent violations is, according to the Supreme Court, it's such a terrible intrusion on state sovereignty that it's unconstitutional. And if that is, then this thing is by 100 times greater degree. We also know from another case, Massachusetts versus Health and Human Services, decided a few weeks ago in federal district court that the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, in part, is unconstitutional because it interferes with the traditional state prerogative and sovereign power of defining what is a lawful marriage and what is not. And as Jack pointed out quite accurately, that same rationale could easily be applied to the health care, the Obama health control law, which does, in a quite massive way, interfere with traditional state powers of regulating insurance and health issues. And the core case on this is Hodel versus Virginia Surface Mining Authority, also still good law, which sets up a three-part test for when a federal regulation interferes with traditional state sovereign powers, and the DOMA failed that, and the health care, I think, pretty clearly fails that as well. It is not true that there are no individual rights involved in this case. There are at least seven lawsuits going on, one by the state of Virginia, which is the first to get a substantial decision. Another 20 states coming together, led by Florida, have suits, and then there are five other suits involving private individuals or sometimes constitutional officers of states, such as the Lieutenant Governor of Missouri. And these do raise substantial individual liberty issues, the most important of which is your right to privacy, particularly your right to medical privacy. We know that there is a constitutional right to medical privacy to some degree. That's what Roe versus Wade says from 1977. We know there's a right to refuse unwanted medical treatment. That's what the Cruzan case says. And we know that in general that there is some right of medical autonomy in making important personal decisions about your life, and that's what Casey teaches us. Now, the boundaries of this have not been entirely worked out, and this is a gray zone, I guess, But it seems fairly clear that if we're going to take those privacy rights seriously, if there really is a constitutional right to privacy, if the courts don't want to overturn that and say there's no such thing as a privacy right, then being forced to disclose to a private company, which will then, by federal law, have to turn that data over to the federal government if the federal government wants it, your intimate personal details, you're having to go through blood tests, urine tests, everything they reveal, your entire medical history, your entire mental health history, the most intimate details about a person's life, being forced to disclose that to a private company you don't want to, is a violation of the your Fifth Amendment liberty rights, and also a violation of your First Amendment rights to choose who you want to associate with or not associate with. And we know that the right of association in the First Amendment also includes the right not to associate, and especially when there are important issues of personal belief and conscience at stake, such as, for example, religious people who don't want to associate with insurance companies that sell that provide abortion services. And under this law, nominally, at least one company in each cartel that you have to buy from in a state will not offer abortion services, but then you end up, in fact, being penalized by having to choose, say, that company's services, which may not be the ones that are right for you and your family. So you are, associational rights are at least arguably at stake. There's also another First Amendment issue in that one of the people, groups that are exempt from, type of people who don't have to buy this forced insurance, are people who participate in a healthcare sharing ministry. But that's defined in ways that amount to religious discrimination, since it'll only be a healthcare sharing ministry that was in existence as of December 31st, 1999. There's no good reason under the First Amendment to discriminate against 21st century religion, new religious entities, and favor 20th century ones instead. There's also a violation of the Privileges and Immunities Clause, which protects, among other things, the constitutional right to travel and to move from one state to another. The changes in the Medicare Advantage funding plan, which is something that people use to choose not to to supplement or add on to their Medicare, is essentially designed to destroy that and drive it out of existence within a few years, except in several counties in Florida. This was the Gatorade package, which was corrupt vote buying in a very raw form. And so people in these selected counties in Florida get to keep Medicare Advantage just the way it's always been. It's very popular. Lots of people like it. And everybody else loses it. And that is irrational, and it is, except in the sense of corrupt vote buying, and it is discriminatory because it means those people are, in a sense, locked into staying to live in Florida instead of moving to Missouri or California because they'll lose tremendous medical care there, and it likewise is discriminatory against everyone else. The claim that it's necessary and proper, finally, is implausible in light of United States versus Comstock, which sets up, decided just a month ago, which sets up a five-part test on federal use of necessary and proper, and it clearly fails, in my view, at least three of the elements. Under Comstock, an exercise of necessary and proper looks at the history of federal involvement in the subject. We do not have federal regulation of insurance till 1974 with ERISA, and we've never forced individuals federally to buy particular insurance products. Another test from Comstock is whether the federal law properly accounts for states' interest, doesn't interfere with state sovereignty, does not supersede the rights and responsibility of the states, and whether there is little intrusion in the ordinary processes and powers of the states. This is the Obama health control law is the opposite of all those things. It's a massive intrusion on traditional areas of state regulation. And finally, the fifth element is whether this is narrowly tailored. In the case of the law that was upheld in Comstock, it applied only to individuals who were already in the custody of the federal government, a small class of persons. The health control law is precisely the opposite. It applies broadly to everyone and puts us, in terms of our most important intimate medical decisions, into the custody of the federal government. This will ultimately be decided by the Supreme Court, but if they stick with their precedents and do not change the law to expand federal power in order to accommodate this for political reasons, it will be struck down. Thank you.
Thanks. I have 4 points that I want to make, and the great thing about going last is that a few of them have been, that I was going to say have been made, so I'm going to focus on the tax power and the commerce power. I'm not going to talk about necessary and proper. I'm going to also going to follow the trend in focusing on current understandings of those powers. And the first point that I want to make is reiterating something that Jack said, and it has to do with the tax power, and it's about the breadth of the tax power. The tax power is not only very, very broad under existing doctrine, it was intentionally so. It was a power that was one of the main concerns of the framers of the Constitution to provide an adequate means for raising revenue, and the constitutional power is, as a result, quite broad. The main political the main check is a political one, and as we all know, it is often quite a vibrant check. The conditions on the constraints that do exist on the tax power, Jack alluded to, I think it's really quite clear that the minimum coverage provision meets them. General welfare, revenue raising. There was this, the Congressional Budget Office estimated $4 billion a year, which is far more than many taxes that have been sustained under the tax power before. That, by the way, was an estimate that was before Congress, before they enacted the bill. It also is clear that the provision, valid tax can't violate an independent constitutional provision. I have a couple of things to say about due process at the end, but I think it's quite clear that the individual, the minimum coverage provision doesn't violate due process. One point that Randy made had to do with the fact that Congress's findings all focused on the Commerce Clause, and I agree with Jack that the political path of this meant that the tax power wasn't articulated as well as it should have been. It's also quite clear under current doctrine that Congress, that a measure can be upheld as within Congress's power, even if Congress doesn't as fully articulate that basis as we might want it to. It is also clear, by the way, in one of the court's most recent tax decisions, Kurth Rand, that the court focuses on the substance rather than the form, right? So that it's called the penalty really is irrelevant. One of the claims you do hear, Jack alluded to, is that this is an unconstitutional direct tax or capitation tax. Under existing doctrine, it's pretty clear, I think, that it's not. The only direct tax is, again, going back very far in time to 1796. The direct tax, what's been seen to be direct tax, has been read very narrowly. It includes capitation taxes and taxes on property. The height of the direct tax interpretation of what's a direct tax was the Pollock income tax text. Decision. And even there, it was never read as broader than taxes on property. So, for example, income taxes on labor were perfectly constitutional. At any rate, it's clear the minimum coverage provision is not a capitation tax. It's not a tax on people by virtue of their existence without any reference to their circumstances. In fact, it's quite clearly tied to circumstance and also to a variety of factors, including income. It's also not tied to the property. It's also, by the way, uniform. There's been no claim raised about the uniformity by any of the plaintiffs that I'm aware of, but it's clear this meets the very minimum requirements for uniform tax. One thing that Dave said had to do with regulatory purpose, and this is actually a point that the recent court decision, I think, tried to avoid and really got wrong. It's clear under existing precedent that the tax power is not limited in the scope to the rest of Congress's enumerated powers. Congress can tax things that it cannot regulate, and indeed, a regulatory purpose does not invalidate a tax. Dave made a point of mentioning that you can't, there are some, the one deviation of this, is there's case law, by the way, going back very far about how the scope of these two provisions is not identical. The one point at which the court deviated from this is in the Lochner era, when it was taking a narrow view about Congress's powers generally, and the Bailey child labor tax case is probably the prime example of this. There's a very good reason to think that those cases have pretty limited validity today, if they have any at all. And the court itself has, by the way, repudiated. So it said we no longer draw the distinction between regulatory and revenue-raising taxes. It's made a point of saying that a tax can raise negligible revenue. It's still constitutional. A tax can have a primary regulatory purpose, and it's still constitutional. But the key thing also to realize is, and I think Dave put it well, he said, you know, you can't throw a tax and add an entire regulatory scheme. Okay, so I question whether or not those cases are still valid. But even if they are, it's quite clear that's not what the minimum coverage provision does, right? So what the minimum coverage provision does is say, basically, if you make a decision to self-insure and enter the healthcare market without buying insurance, right, then you pay a penalty, you pay a tax. The vast regulatory scheme enacted as part of the Affordable Care Act comes through the rest of Congress's commerce and spending powers. This is not as the child labor tax case was, because at that point the court took such a narrow view of the commerce power and the spending power. This is not a case where this provision is the tail that wags the entire dog, right? This simply imposes a penalty for people doing this. The rest of the detailed regulatory scheme is adequately sustained. So that was my point, too, about the regulatory purpose. And I think, you know, the district court in Virginia basically quoted these cases that say it's okay if it has a regulatory purpose, and then proceeded to punt on it and say, actually, if you can't regulate it, then that makes it unconstitutional in the taxpayer, too. That's just not true under the case law. That said, I think you can regulate it. And here I want to get to the point that Randy and Jack really articulated. Well, you know, the essential claim here is that Congress can't legislate against inactivity under its tax power, under its commerce power. Otherwise, I think it's pretty clear, it would be very hard to make any claim that the minimum coverage provision isn't constitutional under, as I said, the tax power, but also under the commerce power, under the Raich decision. This is clearly health insurance, health access to health care. These are clearly health care services. These are clearly economic activity. So instead, they focus on claiming this is inactivity, right? What you're doing here is regulating inactivity, as Randy put it. I think the claim that Congress can't regulate inactivity and that the minimum coverage provision is a regulation of inactivity is doubly false. I think Congress can regulate inactivity. I think it does so all the time, and it has to for regulation to be effective, because the divide between inactivity and activity is so permeable, right? So failure to install pollution emissions equipment, failure to disclose certain transactions, right? We regulate these all the time. And the court, of course, has upheld this kind of regulation. So one of the examples that the government cites in this brief, and I think it's a very good one, is Heart of Atlanta, right? Government says you can't refuse to serve people on the basis of their race, right? Regulating inactivity. The response to that is, oh, no. You don't understand. In those cases, people have individuals have voluntarily undertaken economic activity. Therefore, Congress can come in and regulate. And this, I think, Randy put well earlier. I think that just underscores the point that the divide between inactivity and activity is not one that can be in any way restricted. It's too permeable, and that's not a limit on Congress. And the proof of that, I think, is that it's very easy to see that, in fact, what Congress is doing with the minimum coverage provision is regulating activity, right? Jack put it in terms of the risk pool and when you access health insurance later and health benefits later, and also when you access uncompensated care now. I mean, basically, what individuals are doing by not purchasing health insurance is not staying out of the healthcare market, right? They're voluntarily entering into the healthcare market by obtaining services when they need them, either paying for them or being uncompensated care, but that's voluntary activity in terms of accessing healthcare services, or they're subsequently purchasing insurance when their risk goes up, right? That's voluntary activity at that point. All of these are easily classified, to my mind, as voluntary activity, right? There's the provision of self-insurance is going on. That's an activity. And the key point here is, of course, that no one stays out, or really almost no one stays out of the healthcare market. It's just too basic a need. And Congress is regulating their activity in accessing that market without insurance, right? So I think that's the idea of seeing this as inactivity is a false portrayal. And what I think this gets at, and what I think the real issue here is it's a question of baseline, right? So the plaintiffs and the district court in Virginia are trying to insist on a very narrow definition of the activity at issue, right? They're insisting the baseline is the decision to purchase health insurance in a particular year. There's no reason to take that characterization of the activity at issue. Congress didn't. Congress viewed the activity at issue as far broader, the accession of health insurance and of healthcare services more generally. And there's no reason to assume that the narrow version is particularly an accurate one. In fact, if you go back to Raich, one of the things that Raich says is we are going to defer to Congress on the scope of the class of activities at issue. And if you do that, then this becomes activity, and I think this argument fails. The fourth point I want to make is about due process. Much of the claim that are being made, I think Dave evoked this, Randy did with his idea about the concern about commandeering the people, much of the concern here does sound very much in terms of individual liberty and due process. When you focus on the minimum coverage provision, I think it's clear that the effort to sort of see this as a substantive due process claim is an effort to basically build into the Commerce Clause ideas of economic freedom and economic liberty that have been rejected in the context of substantive due process. And it's an effort to bring them in through limiting the Commerce Clause. And just as we've rejected them in the due process context, we should similarly reject them in the Commerce Clause context. That said, it's important to remember that due process remains, right? So if you do have, and some of the hypotheticals that go out are pretty excessive, if you do have measures that are truly coercive, compelling, invasive of personal autonomy, as those have been understood under due process, then that still remains a mechanism by which those intrusions on individual liberty can be curtailed. This is not such a measure. And the final point I want to make here, because one of the unfortunate things of the lawsuit is that they have framed the debate about the healthcare measure as fundamentally liberty intruding and restricting. It's not. It's fundamentally liberty enhancing. It's fundamentally liberty enhancing for the 32 million people who now have access to health insurance and better healthcare than they ever had before. And we can't lose sight of that, which is also the national exigency that led Congress to enact this measure in our discussions of its constitutionality.
Well, thanks. Thank you to all four of you. What I'm going to do is ask you if you want to rebut anything that somebody else said, not just add what you said earlier, and try to do that in just about 2 or 3 minutes, which would allow us to have about 40 minutes for questions.
Yeah.
Thanks. I have two basic points I want to make, and they're technical, and I'm still going to stay within my spirit of giving you a briefing for purposes of teaching the subject. And they're not the kind of points I would necessarily make to a general audience. It's a point I would make to law professors or a legally trained audience. But before I do, I want to make a sort of a non-technical observation, and that is that the fact that this was a deal made with the private insurance company, this is not companies, which I believe is true. This is not a winning political issue. This is not something that I think Jack, if he decided to run for office in Connecticut, would like to put on his website. It says, yes, Jack Balkin, the man who made the deal with the private insurance companies to make sure that they got plenty of customers after reform was passed. And Connecticut, of course, is the insurance state. So you've got the right. You're living in the right state for this to work. Otherwise, I don't think it's a great idea. It's a great motto. But it's true. It is. It was a payoff to the insurance companies, somewhat against what the Democrats are going to say in the next election cycle. So I just want to make that clear. I think it's the fact of the matter. And Congress, I think, would have had the power to impose a general scheme. If Medicare is constitutional, then Medicare for everyone is constitutional. Social Security is constitutional is for the same reason. They could have had a general taxing scheme. I think there might have been some reasons why there needed to be with Medicare, you can still provide your own private insurance over and above Medicare. For Social Security, you can still provide for your own private retirement accounts over and above Social Security. So I do think there may actually have been a constitutional reason why the English socialized medicine system would have been constitutional, but the Canadian socialized medicine system, which does not allow an opt-out, might not have been constitutional. But we're not even going there. There was never any discussion of no opt-out or supplement, let's put it that way. So I think the government could have done that under existing doctrine, that's all, not necessarily under the original meaning of the Constitution, but there's a reason why they didn't, and that it was politically unpalatable. Now let me just talk about the tax power in that sense. Again, I'm going to start technical, but then I'm going to go a little more general. Technically, there are a lot of cases about Congress's discretionary power to use the tax power. But every one of those cases, not every one of the cases that are relevant, but every one of those cases, in every one of those cases, the power that was exercised by Congress was called the tax power. Every time Congress, every one of those cases which says that Congress may do this thing liberally, Congress called the measure a tax. The question is, but the court said is we're not going to look, in some of these cases, what the court said, we're not going to look behind the label of tax. And this is, by the way, they're not going to substance. They refuse to go to substance as opposed to form. They say, we're going to stick with the fact that Congress called it a tax, and we're not going to look behind to see if their real purpose and their real motive was the regulations was to engage in a regulatory act that was beyond its enumerated powers. We're not going to do that. If it says it's doing a tax, we're going to take it at its word, and as long as it has a revenue-raising purpose and these other criteria. What the argument is now going to be made, and is being made already, is that in a measure where Congress did not call the measure a tax, I realize it's located in the IRS, in the Internal Revenue Code, the IRC, enforced by the IRS, but they did not call the measure a tax. In such, and there are cases, by the way, of when a penalty is considered a tax and when there isn't, and there's substantive standards to be applied to whether that is true, whether a penalty is a tax or not. In a case where they did not call something a tax, but explicitly called it a regulation of commerce, that's what they called it. That's how they justified it. Will the court say, but we will look behind what Congress has called this thing to see whether in substance it could have been justified as a tax, and if we conclude that it would have been justified as a tax, then we'll uphold it. I think that's a principle that's never been adopted formally before. I don't think it'll be adopted this time. And the last thing I want to say that is... But before I get off the tax, then I have one more thing on rage. The last
one more.
Okay. With respect to tax, I think Jack's absolutely right. There's a political reason why the Senate did not call it a tax. There's a political reason why the President denied that it was a tax. And then Gillian says that the only constraint on the exercise of the tax power is political. Well, how does that political constraint work? Here's how it works. You call the thing a tax and see if you want to vote for it. It doesn't work by refusing to call it a tax for, quote, political reasons, which is true, and then saying it's a regulation of commerce only after the fact going to court and justifying it as a tax. So this end run around the political constraints of exercising the tax power is really something that I think the courts are going to balk at. And now let me just talk about rage. I'm going to make a technical point about rage that's something that is really not normally seen, but you really need to know if you ever teach rage, even if you don't teach this issue, and that is what rage was. Was an as-applied Commerce Clause challenge. And that means was that we conceded in Raich that Congress did have the power over the class of interstate activities involving and regulating the drug trade, which was the Controlled Substances Act. We conceded from day one the facial validity of that challenge, of that statute, and said what we were doing, what we needed to do is carve out as applied to a particular subset of the general class, a subset that was beyond the power of Congress to reach. And what the court essentially held in Raich, really for the first time, is we're going to defer to Congress with respect to subsets. If you're talking about a subset of the same activity, in this case a fungible good, the homegrown marijuana is indistinguishable from the interstate marijuana, and Congress decides to reach this whole class, which you yourself concede is within its powers to reach, it has to reach the subclass, we will defer to Congress on that. And then if you go back and look at all the other previous Commerce Clause cases that lead up to Raich, Wickard versus Filburn, as-applied Commerce Clause challenge, even Heart of Atlanta, as-applied Commerce Clause challenge, none of these things were facial challenges to whether the class as a whole was outside the power of Congress to reach. This challenge is a facial challenge. It is not an as-applied challenge. The problem that gave rise essentially to the outcome in all of that line of as-applied challenges just doesn't exist here, which is the problem of subdividing a general class that is conceded to be within Congress's power under the Interstate Power Clause. That's why I think it's not going to be a Commerce Clause issue. It will be a necessary and proper clause issue. It will not be a tax power issue because the implications of that claim are way too radical for the court or for any. But the implications of saying it's necessary and we're not going to get into proper or we have a disagreement with you over proper are not going to be deemed by the court to be as radical, and that's ultimately, I think, where this lawsuit is going to end up.
Jack, you want to take a couple seconds? It's my kind of panelist down there at that end.
Yeah.
Dave?
Here. Well, I think all of you as constitutional law professors or even people who maybe not teach constitutional law but took it at some point, you can have fairly straightforward opinions on the black is white and upside down is right side up argument about the interstate commerce power, that choosing not to buy a product is a form of interstate commerce. But the other argument is on the tax power is something that I think there's probably two or three dozen people in the country who really have studied enough constitutional tax to be deeply and well informed on that. of course, if it is a direct the question on tax is not merely does Congress think that this will advance the general welfare? Does this raise revenue? Of course, it passes those. But there's also the question, the fact is the Constitution requires that taxes be in certain kinds of forms. For example, direct taxes have to be apportioned according to the population, and Jack and Gillian's brief in the Virginia versus Sebelius goes on at great length to argue that this is not a direct tax, so the fact that it's not apportioned by population is no problem. Of course, there is the problem that the case of Eisner versus Macomber from the 1920s would suggest a contrary conclusion, and their approach is to get out the garlic and say, oh, that's from the Lochner era. It's bad. Don't think about that. And besides, even though it's still the law of the land, people don't really pay attention to it anymore. So let's concede on that. Let's say it's not a direct tax. The conclusion of their brief then says, and by the way, court, don't start thinking about what if it's not a direct tax. You don't need to figure out what other kind of tax it is. Well, but actually you do, because the other taxes have their own rules and requirements. For example, is it an income tax authorized by the 16th Amendment? Well, no, it's probably not, because the 16th Amendment authorizes taxation of income derived from whatever source. Well, not buying something ain't deriving income from any source. And you can go to Glenshaw Glass, where Chief Justice Warren gives the definitive explication of what income derived is, and I don't think you can possibly jam the decision not to buy a product into the category of income derived. And so, well, what else do you have there? How about an excise tax? Well, an excise tax is a tax on something. You own property or you engage in some kind of transaction. If you want to have an excise tax on buying potato chips, real easy. Do you want to have an excise tax on owning a big screen television? You can do that too. But you can't have an excise tax on just sitting on your butt watching TV and not doing anything at all. Lying around on your couch and engaging in no activity is not something that is an excise tax. And if you want to say, well, we're just going to tax you for your mere existence, then you're back into being a direct tax, and it has to be apportioned by population. And even if you say it's somehow your non-activity is an excise tax because theoretically it precedes this other activity that you'll eventually engage in. Of course, you could put an excise tax on going to the emergency room without health insurance. That's an easy one to do, because then you're actually doing something. They have to be uniform. And these are not, and there's an argument at least, these are certainly not uniform throughout the United States, as the Constitution requires, because they're not geographically uniform. The particular penalty you pay, according to this law, depends on the particular geographic region you're in, and then the cost of health care there. So there's at least the cost of the lowest insurance plan in your area. The sort of argument that everybody who doesn't do this by the federally mandated insurance is some kind of freeloader who's going to show up at the insurance at the emergency room and send the bill to you, I think overlooks a very important class of people, and that's people who believe in alternative or integrative medical approaches. They don't want it. They're not into the traditional medical industrial complex, and they're perfect. And they now can, and they or people who just want to, partly for privacy reasons or whatever else, just pay for their medical services out of their pocket sincerely, like the way most people paid for medicine through the 1950s and from most of the history of this country. And here's the one claim that I'd suggest on the constitutional issue is novel, or at least requires an extension of the law, but I think it's an easy extension to make. If the federal government said every family in this country has to spend $8,000 a year buying federally approved books, we'll have a cartel of book publishers, and you got to buy, you can buy whatever book you want as long as you spend $8,000 on our federally approved books, would that violate your First Amendment right to buy the books that you want to buy, to not associate with publishers of books you don't like, and to choose, and by taking so much of your income for that, would it interfere with your First Amendment rights to buy the books of your choosing? I'd suggest it probably would. The analogy then works if you have a right of some size to choice in medical care. And the fact is the people who like these alternative or integrative therapies are now getting forced to spend $8,000 or more per family to buy something they don't want, taking money out of their pocket that will, in a practical sense, disable them from being able to seek the kind of medical care that they do want. If there are rights to medical, if there are rights to choice in medical care, and I suggest there's a whole bunch of due process cases which suggest there are, then this is also a violation of their rights to medical choice.
Thanks, sir.
Yeah, I have literally one minute. I just want to make a couple of doctrinal points, actually. One is on uniformity. Again, just looking at the cases, the court has basically pretty much read the uniformity requirement out of existence. And all it requires is that the rule of liability be stated geographically uniformly. Although you can sometimes identify something by geography and it's still geographically okay. So even that is with qualifications. But it's made quite clear that the amounts that you pay don't have to be, right? There, as far as I know, there's actually not been a uniformity claim made about this, but if it were, I think it's really not gonna fly under that case, right? Again, we're talking about current doctrine. Also on the current decision, I just wanted to talk a little bit or reference some of the cases, at least the cases that I'm familiar with, they say we're not gonna go behind Congress's identification of the tax to see we're going to take it at its word. You know, there's a period in which we still have the outlines of the commerce power and the tax power being worked out. Some of this has to do with what I talked about in terms of the question of regulatory purpose. One way of just never having to deal with that is to say it's a tax. We're not going to focus on the regulatory gains or purposes that it might be serving. That plays a role in those cases. And there are also other cases where the court has said we're going to look more generally at congressional power. So while it certainly is possible that the court may adopt more of a clear statement rule in this case, so far at least, I don't believe the case law supports that.
Okay, I want to thank all our panelists, and we're going to now take questions from the audience. And what I'll do is I will repeat the question so it turns up as best as possible for the podcast, and that will also give panelists a second to think about what they want to say. So let's go back here.
Yeah, we can talk doctrine to the face, but I don't know how Justice Kennedy is going to respond to the following points, so I'm curious if the panel as an answer to convince Kennedy this. It's going to be two things. First, all Americans eat food. Eventually, all Americans eat food. The government cannot force us to buy tomatoes. Either buy tomatoes or pay tax. That argument is going to appeal to Justice Kennedy. Should I do that? Second, it does seem to me that a 26-year-old independently wealthy person who wants to go to his American citizen and wants to live by himself farm for a year or go to Europe for a year is standing before the court of lawyers and says to Justice Kennedy, I just want to be left alone. I'm not going to go to the emergency room. I am not going to hire a doctor. I'm not doing any of those things. Just let me be, and I'll pay this tax or commerce clause regulation when I come back into the system. But don't force me into the system. I can't imagine how Jack even convinced Justice Kennedy to be on your side.
Okay, so basically, I'll pass this down, but the question is, how, Jack, are you going to win over Justice Kennedy when he's faced with a young, healthy person who's got plenty of money to pay for his own care, and what about the kind of analogy that the government can't force you to buy food even though you need to eat?
So, just a quick question. So the first thing I tell Justice Kennedy is, this guy's very wealthy, and he doesn't want to pay taxes. What does he get off saying he doesn't want to pay taxes? What is he, a skinflint? What is he, a cheapo? He's rich. You know how much money he's going to have to pay in this tax? The first year, was it, $325? Is that right? It's about $325. So he's standing up in front of the Supreme Court, and he's spending all this money saying, I don't want to pay 325 measly bucks. I don't think Justice Kennedy is going to be impressed. That's point number one. Remember, we're not talking doctrine. We're talking about, second, the guy's loaded. You just told me he's loaded. He plans to go off to Acapulco for a year. Do you know what Justice Kennedy will tell him? If he goes off to Acapulco for a year, he doesn't pay the tax. It doesn't apply to Americans living abroad. The third thing he's going to say is, we're not talking about your buying tomatoes. We're talking about health care, which is governed by insurance markets. Tomatoes are not governed by insurance markets. Insurance markets have a basic economics to them, in which the issues of moral hazard and adverse selection dominate. I assume Justice Kennedy knows all about this stuff, or at least his clerks do. And the point is, this argument is not a general argument about Congress having the power to do everything. It's an argument specifically directed to certain kinds of economic regulations of insurance markets, where the problem of moral hazard and adverse selection is significant. And therefore, I would say, you can tell me all you want about problems of making people buy cars if they're commuters. What I'm going to tell you is this is the Affordable Care Act, and it's about insurance.
And one quick point.
Again, this is part of the public debate in our constitutional moment. Is Jack just described this guy who you portrayed as a sort of nice, sturdy, self-reliant fellow, and Jack turned him into this rich dude who wants to hang out in Acapulco and but then tries to make a constitutional case out of $325 a year. The penalty, so-called tax, goes up pretty quickly in the subsequent years, up to many thousands of dollars for a family. And I'd suggest that some of those people who don't want to buy medical industrial complex product, but from the government, authorized by the government, and give up all their family's personal medical history and intimate details of their life, or before and get stuck with a penalty which will amount to many thousands of dollars, preventing them from being able to afford the alternative or integrative therapies they want. I think that family is real, and I think that family appeals very much to Justice Kennedy's sense of liberty writ large. You look at the favorite words in his opinions. Liberty's a big deal to him.
The one thing I want to say is just bear in mind that, of course, the lawsuits we have before us, the only ones that I know of, well, the main ones, don't involve those kinds of individual claims at all. They may have added some individuals into Florida, but of course the Virginia case is state. The main part of the Florida case is states, right? They can't claim they're going abroad. They're not going to be able to easily put it in that context. And of course, if you try to involve individuals right now, the problem with the individuals particularly is there's a serious rightness issue.
But you might have it better.
True. True.
There's a cutoff point.
Yes.
Is it 300% of poverty line?
I think it is at 300% of the poverty. If the amount that you pay would be more than 8% of your AGI, in addition. There are a variety of cutoffs, right? So you're not subject at all if you're under the poverty line. You get benefits going up a certain amount, up to either 300% or 400% of the poverty line to pay for the penalty. And in addition, you are exempted if for any period of time the payment would be more than 8% of your AGI. So it is very much targeted at people with disposable resources to pay it.
The point is, this is, again, I'm talking about this point in front of you because this is the question I'm asking. If I were arguing this case, I would have over and over again on the keyword affordable. This is the Affordable Health Care Act. The idea is it's designed so that if you don't have a lot of money, you don't pay the tax. That even if you have a little money, the government subsidizes you heavily up to the point where we only be allowed to pay the tax. Are basically people who are, they have a lot of money. As for alternative care, I mean, we didn't talk about a chance to talk about it, but Dana and I are probably on the same page on kind of individual liberty restrictions on what government can do by way of privacy and how they can limit options. Although I'm not sure how we agree on all of them, but for example, for alternative care, the question I would ask is the following. If this person had religious objections, right, to the purchase of insurance, would the federal government be required by the Constitution, not by RFRA, right, but would they be required by the Constitution to give that person an exemption from the tax? It just so happens religious people are exempted, and it just so happens RFRA also applies. But the constitutional question for me would be, would a religious person be required in the Constitution to get an exemption? If they would not, because of Smith, right? I cannot imagine how a person who believes in alternative care would be in a better position than a person with religious objections. And since, as I understand Smith, that door is closed, right, then I think, in fact, the alternative care argument is non-limited. That doesn't mean, as a policy matter, I might have a very different view, but I think as a constitutional matter, it's not a limit, even before Justice Kennedy.
Okay, over here.
I have a question for Randall. I mean, I really think this is going to come down to the necessary and proper clause. It's going to be okay under the Constitutional Powers Clause. The question is it necessary? Is it proper? So I was interested in your saying it's not as a power reserved to the people. Is there a case that makes the distinction in terms of necessary but not proper, but doesn't rely on sort of state government?
No. And the reason is, this has never been done before. So until the 1990s, it had never been done before with respect to states. And a new doctrine that we're now very familiar with, the commandeering doctrine, was devised to deal with, to answer the question of what seems wrong about this. What seems to be the problem of making state legislatures enact things? Not stopping them from enacting things, which is something we're familiar with, but making them enact something. Well, what's wrong with that? And what's wrong with making a very trivial imposition on chief executive officers that they have to run background checks for a temporary period until the federal government gets their own background check thing up and running? Very trivial. What seems to be wrong with that? Well, they had to identify it. I think it's the same thing. It's the first time it's been done. Therefore, it's the first time we have to think about whether we think it's proper or not. So there is case law that says proper is to be evaluated separately than necessary. So we've got that. And it does locate this principle in the 10th Amendment where the or through the people is also there. And then we have to ask ourselves, well, is there something that bothers us about the idea of mandating activity as opposed to prohibiting it or as opposed to regulating people who choose to engage in certain kinds of activity? And I think I'm just trying to put my finger on what's bothering so many millions of people. I mean, part of the framing of this whole thing, which I agree framing is super important, it's not going to be done by law professors. Part of the framing is being done by the kind of popular constitutionalism that Jack has written so much about. And to some degree, you know, law professors can publish and write what they want, but the framing is going to be brought to this case and brought to Justice Kennedy by a subset of the American people. I hate talking about the American people because I'm usually a minority dissenter amongst the American people, so I don't like being lumped in with everybody. But there's a substantial subset of the American people who react to this the way I've been suggesting. And I think that it's not... Oh, and one other thing I will say about the 10th Amendment in terms of what the case law says, and that is it's Justice Thomas's dissenting opinion in U.S. v. Term Limits, where he points out that the 10th Amendment is neutral with respect to states versus the people. He makes this point that textually it's noncommittal as to who has the power left over after the delegation of power issue, and it's the states or the people. And then he renews that quote. He repeats that quote in his dissenting opinion in Comstock, and that's the opinion that Justice Scalia joins. And in there, there's another discussion of necessary and proper, which also reiterates the Prince the line in Prince that this is the last refuge of those who argue for the ultra-virus powers of Congress. So even in the dissenting opinion of Justice Thomas in Comstock, you see a renewal of his argument in U.S. v. Term Limits that the 10th Amendment actually applies to the people as well as to the states. And I think that's another place on which that new doctrine to respond to the new mandate could be grounded.
Okay. Arno.
I want to follow this up. On a couple of points you made, to some extent it's relevant to this, the things that David said. The fact that it's unprecedented, this particular method is unprecedented, is true of almost every major Commerce Clause case I can think of that's come before the court. Where it was the first time you dealt with home consumption, part of Atlanta was the first time you dealt with who restaurants were serving. I mean, just go down the list. It's all unprecedented. Yeah, it's the first time you've done it this way. So I guess I don't think that gets you very far. And on the improper point that Bill was raising, unless I'm missing something, the fact that it interferes with what previously was state sovereignty, I think this court closed by going as far back as McCulloch, but yeah. When the federal government does do something different, that takes something that used to require state sovereignty, as long as it's within federal power, definitionally, that takes it outside the scope of the 10th Amendment. But the commentary cases, I think, are quite different because they were asking for the state to help. You're outside the scope of the common hearing cases, I think. If the federal government is saying, look, we'll do it, stay the heck out of this, stay on the sidelines, we'll do it, we don't want any help from them. Then I think we're okay with that. And I guess, David, this maybe is more directed to you since you referred to Comstock. It strikes me as surprising, at least, to say that the federal government under the Necessary and Proper Clause, and I'm not quite sure what else it was attached to, can say you can keep a person in your custody even though his prison term is up and even though you have no right to keep him there except that you've said it, and then say, well, that's different because this statute applies to more people. In the first place, I don't think the federal statute functionally applies to everybody. I may be wrong and I may find out I'm wrong. But I think as long as I'm buying health insurance from Texas Tech School of Law, and as long as I have supplemental insurance from my emeritus employer, the University of North Carolina, that nobody's going to come in and say that insurance isn't good enough. It's purely for the people who do not have insurance. Now, I'll grant you that's probably a higher number than the number of people who the state's going to continue to hold. But to say it's within federal power to hold people who are no longer under sentence of crime because somebody thinks they might be dangerous and evidently not the state in which they're living, since otherwise the state would have held them. But that's fine. But it's not fine to say that we want to be sure that everybody has health insurance. It strikes me as not only wrong but perverse in terms of what you're allowing the federal government to do in Comstock and what you would not be allowing them to do under this statute.
Okay, so we've got.
That's my question, sir.
Yeah, we've got kind of overlapping questions, but for Andy, I guess mainly sort of a commerce question again, aren't all these cases new and distinguished a little better? And then the Comstock question for Dave, and
yeah,
let the
I'm not going to do the Comstock. I'll let Dave do the Comstock then. I just want to make clear, I said in the very first talk, my very first 10 minutes, the fact that something is unprecedented doesn't mean it's unconstitutional. I made that point right up front. And so I think that's true. In addition to the fact that it's the first time, you have to decide, well, is it should be allowed? So you're basically reiterating the point I was insisting upon in the beginning. However, previous to the claim that it's unprecedented, we heard an awful lot, not from folks like Jack Balkin, but we heard a lot about from the administration itself or from Nancy Pelosi and from a lot of law professors that rushed to the reporters across the country saying, this is easily justified under existing doctrine. And it's just not. It is something that is not easily justified under existing doctrine. It does require a new evaluation, and the fact that it's unprecedented is a response to why it would be that the reason why this mandate is improper might be a theory that we don't have any previous cases about, because it hasn't happened before. And once you realize that, then you have to do something new, and then we have to decide, is there something proper or improper about requiring everybody in the country go and do business with a private company? And that's so that's how the issue will, and that makes, and then I do think at that point, even though there are burdens of proof of who has to show something's unconstitutional, who has to, I do think it puts both sides on somewhat of an equal footing before the courts. The courts are going to decide whether they like this or they don't like this argument. It's not going to be this huge presumption in favor of X, especially if this legislation remains unpopular.
Dave, on the contrary.
I mean, sometimes Congress comes to the Supreme Court and says, I want more. And the court goes, sure, you can have more.
And that's what they did in Wicker. They expanded the scope of the interstate commerce power. That's what they did in the Heart of Atlanta Motel, or especially the Ollie's Barbecue Companion case. Yes, you can have more. And then all of a sudden in 95, Lopez has decided, and some people are very upset because, we've always had more. Whenever we asked for more for the last 50 years, we always got more. Well, yeah, but that doesn't mean you're always going to get more and more and more forever. So now when they're coming back and asking for still more, who knows whether they get it or not. Necessary and proper, the same. I think Comstock was wrongly decided. I agree with you. But the point is that even there, where they took necessary and proper way beyond where you and I would agree it should ever go, even then, they set up a five-part test, and the health control law clearly fails several elements of that five-part test. And by the way, despite what the president promised, you can't keep your insurance. It'll be meant. Some policies are grandfathered, so if you never leave your current employer, you may be okay. But lots of people are going to get their coverage dropped because it'll be cheaper to push them out and the corporation pays the penalty, and so you get stuck in the pool of the government mandated cartels. And there are massive controls on existing insurance. Nobody's complaining. If the government just wanted to raise taxes and then to do it like food stamps, well, in fact, like Medicaid, if you just want to raise taxes and give health insurance vouchers or a government-operated health system or whatever to more people, we wouldn't be having these particular constitutional arguments. But it is using the necessary and proper clause to control the delivery of health care to almost every individual in the United States. It's not merely a welfare program.
I'm going to send this down to Jack for a few comments on that.
Actually, it's a slightly different issue because, you know, most of you know that I do a lot of work on American political development, political science-y stuff, as well as the doctrinal stuff. So I want to talk about actually something that's sort of common theory stuff as opposed to the doctrine. I want you to try to understand what this dispute is against the background of theories of constitutional change. So when Ramsey says he disagrees with Nancy Pelosi saying that the thing is frivolous, right? There's a really important set of constitutional theory issues that are just lurking beneath the surface of that remark. My own view, in fact, is that the mandate is easily justified under the understandings of the current constitutional regime, the sort of New Deal Great Society regime, which is the regime under basically which we're living, right? But what's at stake here, what's actually going on, and you can forget about the individual mandate, just read the papers. Think about how politics is forming in America. Think about the arguments being made. What's happening right now is this big constitutional conversation about what direction the country is going to go in. And a little background. Reagan's presidency launched the possibility of a serious remaking of constitutional understandings. And to some extent, there was a remaking. That is to say, the religion clause rules were changed, I think in some ways to the good. There were a lot of other changes. But in fact, there wasn't a very significant change in the same style as a civil rights revolution or the New Deal before. And so the conservative movements, basically the last 30 years, have been trying to get up the hill to create a significant change in how Americans understand their Constitution, what the true Constitution means. The election of 2008 came at a very unfortunate time for those movements because there was an economic crisis, and that put the other guys in power. And it created the possibility, with the Obama presidency, of not only cementing the existing regime in place, but in some sense expanding that regime's dreams, right? What was the great left problem? Not left liberal, but left, the thing that was left behind. What was the great thing that the Democrats in this whole tradition hadn't done? They hadn't guaranteed health insurance. That was the last remaining piece in the puzzle. And so there was this big Donnybrook over this piece of legislation, which was understood by everyone as being a central question about the nature of the Constitution and American public life. And people fought like cats and dogs over it. It was really a big deal. It was constitutional, right? And what we're seeing now in this debate is the echo of that constitutional debate in a form in which it can be presented to the courts. It's now being presented in the form of commerce and tax and necessary and proper and commandeering, right? Because that's the way in which the doctrine allows us to have that argument with law professors. But we should never forget that what's actually going on is the reverberation of this big fight over these grand visions of American constitutionalism. And the fight isn't over yet, precisely because think about what the 2010 and 2012 elections are going to be about. The 2010 election, the Democrats are probably going to take a bath. They're going to take a bath because the economy hasn't gotten better, but also because it'll be a way in which the Republican Party can say, this is not the direction we want the American Constitution to go. Right? And that will lead to the big, big fight over 2012. And a lot will depend on who the nominee is in 2012 Republican Party. A lot will depend on what happens with the economic recovery. A lot will depend, in other words, on basically what the American people think. Do they think this was a great achievement, the healthcare bill, or do they think it was a colossal, tragic mistake? And that, in turn, will affect the way in which lawyers talk about it and the way courts will decide it. That's the big story behind our dispute over the technicalities of doctrine. That's what's really going on here. So when Randy says, Pelosi was wrong to say this wasn't frivolous, what he's saying, in some sense, is this fight isn't over yet. We just still don't know what the meaning of these events are. We're in the middle of it.
I want to agree with that very important point Jack makes, and then make a slightly different, disagree about some of the empirics, not the overall statement of what's really going on, because that is what's really going on. And the two variations or corrections I would add, in my view corrections, is that one, this is not a top-down driven phenomenon that's coming from law professors or from the conservative intellectual movement. It's not a constitution of exile movement thing like Cass Sunstein and Rosen. Jeff Rosen, we're trying to tell a story in the New York Times. It's not that kind of thing. And it's not a Republican Party thing. The Republicans knew nothing about any of the constitutional issues here and were completely oblivious to them, frankly, until it finally focused their attention in the Senate and things got rolling at that point. So this is not a Republican Party initiative, and it is not a top-down law professor, intelligentsia, or conservative intellectual movement position. This is an indigenous bottom-up movement objecting to what law professors have accepted as what they call the New Deal settlement. Law professors have always overinterpreted the New Deal settlement, for one thing. Law professors had taught until 1995 that Congress can do whatever it wants with respect to the economy. And it was absolutely news out of the blue to law professors in 1995 that might not be true. Renewed again, and they didn't even believe it in 1995 with Lopez. So they had to be hit over the head again with Morrison and in 2000. And then when Raich came along, they go, "Oh, we were right all along. Congress can do everything it wants." It was a 10-year blip. It was a hiatus. But that stuff, the stuff that the political movement that led to Lopez and led to Morrison, even though law professors don't agree with it and have overinterpreted the New Deal mandate, came out of the Reagan revolution. Which was a political movement, which only accomplished X and didn't accomplish Y and Z. And so this thing has been building for 20 or 30 years, and it has to do with the fact that there is a significant portion of the American people who do not accept the law professor. And I say law professors now because that's who's interpreting what's going on, and that's who will be interpreting in class, who do not accept the law professor's understanding of what happened after the New Deal. They might accept part of it, but they don't accept all of it. And now it's been delivered to their doorstep. As long as you were regulating the insurance companies, they really didn't care that much. But now that you've mandated that they do stuff, all of a sudden you have their attention. And now we'll see how the issue gets framed, now that their attention is awakened to this. And that's what's different. The mandate really did do something. Because the mandate is different than anything that's ever been done before, it actually got people to wake up because they're the ones being mandated, and some of them are asking fundamental questions without benefit of law professors saying, can the government do this? Do they have the power? If you go out, I have to go out there and talk to folks like this, and I have to explain to them the New Deal settlement. I have to say, how could this be constitutional? I have to explain to them, I give them the conventional law professor's understanding of why it's constitutional, and this is all their eyes are going like, are you kidding me? Are you crazy? So the American people are not necessarily on board with the law professor's understanding of what the New Deal did and did not do. I said the American people. A significant portion of the American people. I hate that kind of talk. 71%.